Hello and welcome to the Burrow Arch Podcast. We have a race upon us. We have a first place to the halfway award. A bunch of people have taken their 24-hour rests. We have run in with bison and much more. Let's kick it off.
Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to this sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of this sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on mushing.com.
So, Robert, today you had six episodes with junior mushers for our other show, The Dog Driver, that you do with our friend Karosh Partow. And you asked the kids and one of the dads who their favorite band or song was, and three of them said, AC/DC? Well, to pay homage to the great band from Down Under and bring it back to Mushing, we have to talk about Back in Black. So here are a few lyrics. Back in black, I hit the sack. I've been too long. I'm glad to be back. Yes, I'm let loose from the noose that's kept me hanging about. I've been looking at the sky. Cause it's getting me high. Forget the hearse, cause I never die. I got 9 lives. Cat's eyes. Abusing every one of them and running wild. Now, hold on just a second. This is one of the CDs, cassette tapes, whatever you want to call it, that I played until it broke in my 1971 Buick Skylark. In the late 80s, when I would drive to and from high school.
What in the world is up with AC/DC and Mushing? I've been asking this question for a few years now as part of our audiophile feature with everybody that has been on our podcast a whole bunch of times. And one guy, Marcel Marin, who is the race organizer for one of my top 10 races in the world, the Underdog 100, way up in Canada, said he listens to AC/DC every single time he hooks up a dog team. It does fit 100% with the Iditarod, doesn't it, Michelle?
It sure does. But I got to tell you, as much as I am a AC/DC fan, when I hook up my dog team, especially during dry land season, what gets me going is Fuel by Metallica.
I'm more of a Rob White Zombie guy, Godsmack, Slipknot, something of the such.
And Yo-Yo Ma?
Oh, yeah, Yo-Yo Ma. Yo-Yo Ma from the Goat Rodeo, for sure. So, yeah, it is interesting to hear what other people listen to, especially these kids. It's always fun. This is one of the new features that we're adding this year, and I know people like it. So we're going to talk here in just a second to our featured guest of the year, Jonathan Hayes from mushmane.com. But before we do that, it has been a very busy day out on the Iditarod Trail, and it's shaping up to be one heck of a race. They're getting ready to head over to what we call the second third of the race, the Mighty Yukon. We're going to talk a lot about that tomorrow and probably the next day. But let's kick off our interview between Jonathan and I that we recorded earlier at about 4:30 Alaska time, and we're recording this at around 8:30, so about 4 hours later. Let's go. Jonathan, welcome back to the Burled Arch Podcast. We are dead set towards the middle of the race. How's it going today?
It's great. It's shaping up to be a nice race now that everyone's coming out of the 24. It looks like leaders are starting to shape up in the race. And, of course, I think once they get on the Yukon, by the time they hit Caltag, I think that's even going to divide up even more.
Yes, so let's do what we normally do, the top five, bottom five. Jesse Holmes, mile 425 and resting with 550 to go. Paige Drobny, same. Millie Porcelud at 414 and 561 to go, and she is running. Ryan Reddington also running at 406, so about 7-ish miles behind Millie. 569 to go. And I know we were talking right before air. These two guys are leapfrogging each other, Ryan and Michelle Phillips. They're both at 406 and running. And everybody looks to be about the same speed. The difference in speed right now, just between sixth and seventh, is less than a mile an hour. So then we have at the back of the pack currently, we have Jody Potts-Joseph, who is resting at mile 311. Grayson Burton, same spot. That's 664 miles to go. Sadie Lindquist at 311 as well. And then Sam Papperman at 311 as well. And to catch everybody up, it looks like Jesse has done or is doing right now his 24-hour rest. Paige Drobny is the same. Millie is the same. Ryan Reddington is the same. Michelle Phillips. And all the way down to the top 12 mushers are either doing or have done their 24-hour rest. And one other stat as we're talking. So with Jesse at 421 and Jody at 311, there is 110 miles of trail that separate those two teams. So let's jump into that first. Jonathan, can we give our listeners a little bit of perspective there? What does it look like as a dog musher to have 110 miles in front of you and the leading team?
Yeah, that's that's a day, and that's a day and a half of travel. Not a day and a half, but over a day. So at this stage in the race, of course, for someone in the back of the pack, they're not going to be in that competitive mode of trying to win the race. They're the people in the back of the pack are all about getting their teams healthy and happy across the finish line, and nursing that team and getting as many of those dogs to the finish as possible. A full day's travel is what we're seeing between those two spots.
And it's interesting to note that those five in the back of the pack are all rookies. And we talked a lot last night about the run rest schedules and the strategy behind that. And some of that, of course, is in place. Some of those guys are running other people's teams, and it was set, hey, you know what? You go out and run your race, but I want you to run a much slower race. Don't go out there blazing trail. So it's could be built into the strategy, right?
It's really hard to do, not to run your own race. And I was listening to Bruce Lee this morning talk about how we're in a more conservative age of the Iditarod because, used to, you'd see these really big, bold moves, a gamble to see if you could break away and really create some distance. But over the years, everyone who's done those gambles and, we've seen how they played out and how they haven't played out. For the most part, we're in a really conservative age of the Iditarod where everyone knows what works for the most part. And, the leaders are running very, similar schedules, and these races are won and lost by how efficient you are in a checkpoint, and those little minutes, picking up a minute here and a minute there.
And I'm thinking right off the bat when you say that, I know Martin Bucer used to be notorious for that. He would lead out of Willow, guns a-blazing, do a 250 mile run with very little rest, and then he would take his 24 and continue on down the trail. And of course, that has changed quite a bit. I know Lance Mackey did something very similar, not like it used to be, like you said. But then there's also the strategy, not necessarily this year, but some of the non-competitive teams, if you will blaze ahead and collect some of these awards that are offered. Last night we talked about the Spirit of Alaska Award, and we're going to talk about the Halfway Award in just a second. So even if you don't think you can win the race, if you're out front, guns a-blazing, and you collect two or three or four of these awards, and each one of them pay out several thousand dollars, that could be the difference between a decent payday in Iditarod and the $1,049 check that you get if you just finish. I'm sure you would agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, these guys know that there's a difference in, like we talked about last night, in running a 200 to 300 mile race and running an 1,100 mile race. And you know, blazing out like that, you know, you're running that team like it's a 300 mile race. And maybe, you know, at your 24, maybe you can recoup that, or you know, get them back onto a gentler track that'll get them to the finish line. But otherwise, you know, you're just, you know, gambling with, you know, the possibility of having to scratch for pushing your team too hard or dropping too many dogs.
As they say in Vegas, you're playing with house money, right?
Exactly. And you know, just since you and I have been talking just in the last few minutes, Michelle passed Ryan again, at least on the GPS. So slot 2, 3, and 4 are women in the Iditarod. Of, you know, the second, third, and fourth place currently are women. So this could be the year. And I know you were talking about that with your wife on an earlier episode of this, that, you know, it would really be cool to have another woman champion in the Iditarod.
It has been a while, and as they say, the month of March is International Women's Month and Women's Day and all that, so we definitely have to play kudos to those guys a little bit. And I always like to preface, Jonathan, that we're recording this right now at around 4:30 Alaska time, so this is all dependent on at the moment that we're talking. Of course, this could all change in 15 minutes. I mean, we've talked.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we've talked on the show, Jonathan. If you've been a fan for a while, you or anyone else, we've had musher profiles where we're, you know, telling about people's race and all of that. And then right after we air, something happens. We've even had people scratch that we're profiling right here on the show. So it is a 24-hour fluid race for sure. Let's talk very quickly about the Dorothy G. Page Halfway Award. And I do want to point people to a series I'm doing right now with one of the first people that did the first Iditarod, Rod Perry. We're doing a 4-part series with him on the podcast, and he goes in depth, I believe it's on the second episode, about Dorothy Page's role in the race. And it's a little bit different than what most people know. So I highly encourage people to go take a listen to that. Dorothy Page is often credited as the mother of Iditarod, with Joe Reddington Sr. as the father. So the Halfway Award is credited, or honoring, I guess, Dorothy G. Page. It is for the person that is first to the halfway checkpoint, and that is the Cripple Checkpoint. It is Jesse Holmes this year, bib number 7. And he is that first person to come in there with 16 dogs, so he still has a full team. And I think this is a little bit of addition to this award, but he has either the choice of $3,000 in gold nuggets, so a little bit of an investment depending on how well gold does these days, or, I think this is the new part of this, a smartphone of his choosing, with a free year of GCI mobile service. And GCI is a big time sponsor of Iditarod. It is our local internet and cell phone provider up here. So I'm going to pose this question to you, Jonathan. I know he doesn't have to decide right now, and I very seriously doubt if he did take the gold nuggets, he put them in his pocket and is working his way up the trail. But what would you choose if you had to? Would you choose the gold nuggets or a smartphone and a free year of service? And do you think it's about the same amount of money?
I don't know what the gold nuggets would be worth right now. I would say that, you know, just knowing me, I'm an old soul, so I would definitely go for the gold nuggets and probably never cash them in. It'd probably just be an heirloom that I'd keep in my family. I don't know what Jesse would do. I know, you know, modern high-end cell phones especially go for a lot of money now.
And it looks like, looking it up right this second, that gold is worth $5,109.70. So,
well, there you go.
So I guess it's what, about a little less than a half of an ounce of gold that that Jesse would get. So he's not getting those big gold bars that you always see on the bank robbery movies.
You know, you mentioned this, and I'm looking. I see that three of the top five, including Jesse, have a full 16 dog complement on their team, including Ryan Reddington. Our listeners, we didn't talk about this yesterday, but Ryan Reddington came down with, he didn't know if it was food poisoning or something. It just really, really got him sick. But he's a fighter, so he is recovering while traveling. And so for him to be in the top five with 16 dogs while recovering from either a flu bug or a stomach bug is pretty impressive.
It is. And remember, those dog drops, I know that they have a politically correct term for that now. I can't think of what that is, but that is another part of the strategy. And we definitely talk about that as we lead into the last third of the race. So let's talk a little bit about some of the big news of today. I know we mentioned this last night. We talked about Sadie and her encounter with a bison / buffalo, and we're going to describe what that is in just a second, but also Jody Potts Joseph had a run-in as well. I've been gone most of the day, so I didn't watch a lot of the insider coverage, but what do you know? Because I know both of those stories came out relatively early this morning.
Yeah, I as we talked about last night on the show, I really wanted to, you know, find out more about this story, and luckily, you know, there were three or four interviews today that dropped with Sadie and Jody. So I got to hear their stories. And what first came out with a video that, you know, Iditarod is sharing on their social media and everything was only, I guess, the first part of the interaction. And what that is, you know, Jody Potts Joseph, she's Native American, and she was sharing how her Glock misfired. The musher behind her also had an automatic handgun that misfired. Neither one of them could get their handguns to work. So she's throwing sticks at the bison that's charging her team and you know, hiding behind a tree and yelling at it and all like that. And then she's telling this really awesome story, actually, that she remembered a story. She remembered her grandmother telling her when a grizzly bear was attacking her mother as a child, that her grandmother said in their native language, you know, spare us, you know, leave us, you know, and she said the words in her native tongue. And so she remembered that from her grandmother telling her that story. And then she says those words to the bison, and the bison turns around and leaves. So that was just really cool story, amazing story. But then I listened to Sadie's story, and Sadie's story was their guns froze up. We had revolvers, so we brought revolvers up, and you know, shots were fired. Don't think an animal was killed, but it just kind of shook it off and ran away. So those stories didn't mesh to me. They weren't lining up. So, you know, I did some further digging, and then I found another more thorough description from Jody, where Jody is saying that there was actually two encounters. The first encounter was when, you know, the guns misfired. They wouldn't work properly. She spoke in her native tongue to the bison, and it ran away. And then Sadie lent her revolver, and they went a few miles down the trail again and ran into either the same bison or another one, I don't know. And that's when, you know, the shots were fired in order to get the bison to leave. But yeah, either way, you know, and you know, and both of those stories sync together when you hear it in full. But man, that had to be harrowing. And you know, speaking from someone, you know, with some experience with a moose, not a woodland bison. One other thing I'll say about this before I shut up is, there's been some talk about how these woodland bison were introduced to the area as a game species and they're non-native. That's actually not true. Woodland bison are native to interior and western Alaska, but they were you know, hunted to extinction in the early 1900s. And so it's a reintroduction program that they are a traditional native species to Alaska.
And I'm going to ask you about your encounters with a moose here in just a second. I've had one or two myself up here in Alaska, and maybe we can talk about that for some flavor, especially for our outside listeners as well. But I have to ask, since you are a biology teacher, and we were talking about ecology and all of that yesterday, my understanding of buffalo/bison are literally in places like Yellowstone and down the lower 48 mm-hmm. and all that. Yeah. I have not seen these guys in the wild. Do you know the difference between the buffalo and the bison? And is it similar to a caribou and a reindeer, like domesticated versus non-domesticated? Yeah. When you're thinking of that.
So buffalo and bison are interchangeable terms, but what you're thinking of with the Yellowstone region and the Great Plains is the plains buffalo, and you know, what you're dealing with, what Jody Potts Joseph was dealing with is a woodland bison, a woodland buffalo. And we actually, when we were coming into Alaska for the expedition and we crossed through Yukon, we had to stop several times because of woodland buffalo just standing in the road. And, you know, that whether it's moose or buffalo, that's the problem. That's the problem that Jody and Sadie ran into. It's the problem that my son and I ran into when we were mushing a few years ago. When the snow is deep and there is a packed trail, you know, these guys, they see your dog team as a wolf pack, and that is their ancient enemy. It's hardwired into their DNA. You know, that the wolf pack is their enemy. They see your dog team. They see it as a wolf pack. And they know they have the advantage as long as they'll stay on that packed trail in that competition with your wolf pack. But if they leave the trail into the deep snow, then the wolves, you know, and I'm putting that in quotes, you know, your sled dog team, in their mind, the wolves then have the advantage because they can move over the top of the snow while the moose or bison are getting bogged down in the snow. So they are really, really reluctant late in the winter to relinquish that trail. And oftentimes will stand their ground, as you know, will stand their ground and go toe-to-toe against the dog team rather than, in their mind, leave the trail, go into deep snow, and make themselves vulnerable to a pack of wolves.
Yeah, I've had a bunch of encounters with moose over the years. I think they're probably Alaska's most dangerous animal.
Absolutely.
You know, I know muskox have their druthers as well, and of course now these bison. But yeah, just last Saturday I had my college class out, and we lead out with snow machines with those guys, and of course they're behind us a bit of ways on dog teams. And often, even now in the more populated areas where we are, the moose are habituated to snow machines, and they don't even want to get away from us anymore. They will definitely stand their ground, like you said, in the later winter, when of course we have much more snow. Before you mm-hmm. tell your story, I'm just thinking about a podcast that we recently did with Bridget Watkins, Iditarod finisher, came out with a new documentary called Without Warning. Definitely go check that out. It's over on Amazon. We'll put a link to it here in the show notes. And really cool interview that we did about a month ago. But I know you had an encounter that caused a little bit of press, even got a chance to talk to the governor, if I remember correctly, about this encounter, right?
That's right. My son was training for the Can-Am Crown sled dog race. And it was just a few nights before the Can-Am, which is why, you know, the timing of all that with the press just kind of amplified the story. But, you know, I was spotting him, you know, road intersections and checking in on him every 10 miles or so just to make sure he's good on the snowmobile. And we saw, you know, moose tracks heading back toward the kennel, and we were literally 100 yards from our kennel, and moose was standing in the trail and, you know, it was pulling the Gandalf the Gray, "You shall not pass." And of course the dogs, you know, my son, you know, I weigh 200 and none of your business pounds, but my son is, you know, he was a little 140 pound guy, and, you know, the team was just dragging him straight to the moose. So, and I have a 44 Magnum revolver. I don't trust automatic guns in cold. I love revolvers. I've got a 44 Magnum Peacemaker that I carry with me. And that night I did not have it with me. And I knew I could anchor that team better than him. So, you know, I grabbed the team and told him, you know, go down a couple miles away. Some friends of ours that had a house nearby and borrow their rifle. And when he came back, the moose was still going between the yearlings in the dog yard and then coming back and charging our team, and then going and stomping on the yearlings in the dog yard and coming back and charging our team. And just so he handed me the rifle, and then I thought, this is, I'm going to have to call the game wardens. And when I do, this is going to make the news. So I said, "How would you like to shoot your first moose?" So I handed the gun back to him. And the next time the moose charged back at our team, you know, he shot it down. And yeah, they're just, and it's sad, you know, it was a hard winter, and I understand the psyche of these animals. And, you know, we hated to do it. We really, that was a 20-minute ordeal at least. And, you know, we kept hoping at some point this moose is going to say, "Okay, you know, I've had enough," and turn around and wade off into the woods. But that just never happened.
And how long was that from the time you saw him until that whole scenario was over? Was it minutes, hours?
You know, it seemed like an eternity. And I can tell you that, you know, he did a mile and a half snowmobile down to our neighbors and then came back with a rifle, and the assault from the moose was still going on. So it was a good, I would say, at least 15 to 20 minutes.
Yeah. And just a quick aside to that, I remember we were traveling up to your place in northern Maine. Me and a mutual friend of ours, Jeremy Grant, were heading up to have dinner with you one night, and we were cruising up one of the back roads there, and we saw a Maine moose. And I said, he says, "Hey, look, there's moose." And I said, "Yeah, yeah." I said, "Man, is that a baby? That looks really small." And he says, "No, that's a full-size moose." And then he came up, I'm thinking maybe a month or so later, or maybe later that fall, and he saw one of our Alaskan moose. And he said, "Robert, now I know what you're talking about. you guys have some big moose up there." But yeah, they are a force to be reckoned with. And how does this all tie back to Iditarod? Of course, with the encounters today, with the bison there on the trail. And then what was it, last year or the year before with Dallas? That was the year before, yeah. Right?
It was the year before last, because I think Jesse won last year and Dallas won the last time he ran. So I think that was 2 years ago. He had, you know, similar experience. He had to, you know, dispatch the moose, you know, and Iditarod rules is if you have to dispatch a charging animal, you have to field dress that animal. And he did, but he did not do it to the satisfaction of the race. And of course, you know, I mean, if you've got 16 amped up dogs and there's blood and meat and, you know, the smell of a moose there, you know, how long can you sit there and play, you know, field dressing a moose? So he gutted it, you know, pushed it off the trail and kept going. And he got penalized some time for that. And despite that, still won the race. But, you know, these stories, they go all the way back. You know, Susan Butcher was in the lead of the race and had a run in, you know, similar to, you know, what these mushers this year have, you know, what Jody Potts Joseph, you know, had. And she as the story goes, she always, you know, made fun of the men for carrying firearms because she had never had the need for one in all of her runs. And, you know, so here she is with a moose just decimating her team. And as, you know, as the story was relayed to me, her competitor behind her pulled up and had a revolver and dispatched the moose. But by then it was too late. It had, you know, I think destroyed half of her team.
Mm, yeah, it's a scary situation. And just one quick aside to Dallas. I believe he did that very early in the race. I think he was on his way to Finger Lake. So he's in between Squintna and Finger Lake, if I remember correctly, before the Alaska Range, down in that wooded area of the trail there before he's high into elevation. And it was in the middle of the night he had to do that. This is definitely a 24-hour race for sure. So always interesting stories, and I love if we have a little bit of personal perspective to add to that. We hope that our listeners, especially if they've not been to Alaska or have not spent a lot of time outdoors, get a little bit of the flavor of what things like this can happen, because at any moment with a dog team, you might be out there bebopping along on a training run, and like you said, and things can smack you in the face pretty dang quickly. So other than that, Jonathan, any other quick stories you want to share before I let you go today?
You know, I hear a lot of very seasoned veterans of this race talking about how cold it's been. So I know that, you know, they are dealing with that. And some of them are, you know, are expressing that it's been really cold, and others are, you know, brushing it off and saying it's just, you know, another day at the office.
Yeah, it's been chilly here for sure. I think this has been one of the coldest winters we've had here in South Central since we've been up here going on 16 years now. We've had about 3 out of the 4.5 months of well below zero temperatures here. I think it was minus 21 here in Willow. And of course, it's much colder there, and probably even colder in the swamps and the rivers and creeks and all that. It tends to get quite a bit colder there. So what's going to happen in the next 24 before we're back on tomorrow? We will have our first to the Yukon and that award there. We'll talk a little bit about that. And then we have the mighty Yukon, a very long stretch of the race. I like to call it the second third of the race, a little bit different strategy there than the first part. You will see things begin to spread out a little bit, especially as everybody begins to take those 24-hour rests. And remember that on the Yukon, they do have to take a mandatory 8-hour rest as well. There are 3 rests that they have to take, a 24 at some point, an 8 on the Yukon, and then an 8 at White Mountain. So that's what's happening between now and tomorrow. We will have a really good idea of how things are shaking out. Jonathan, anything else before we go?
No, it's shaping up to be a great race. And just to circle back to the expedition class, looking at Thomas Warner and the philanthropist that's with him, they're about, I think, 40 miles, 425 and 4. Yeah, about 40 miles ahead of first place. And of course, you know, again, you know, they're refreshing dogs and, you know, able to, you know, bring in new dogs as well as, you know, the old ones. So I think they're, you know, they're definitely not being a drag on the race. They're staying well ahead, and they'll probably be into Ruby by morning.
Yeah, and they have done a little bit of a website update on that. They do list all of those guys at the bottom of the standings. So you got to do a little bit of clicking around to see where they are on that race, because the trackers on the map on Iditarod Insider, they are showing those guys, like you said, well out front. So it's interesting to see how that's going to develop and how it plays out for the next of the race. I haven't heard much about the Canadian guy and Jeff King and Andy Poole and Jessica Klika, who are following him along.
The Canadian philanthropist that is traveling with Jeff King. I did watch an interview with him yesterday where He made a gentle complaint that he wasn't happy about how slow Jeff King was insisting that they run their teams, that he wished that they were moving more quickly. But you know, this is a tortoise in the hare. This is a tortoise race. You know, this is an endurance race over several days and 1,000 miles. So and he's definitely got good guidance with Jeff King there.
Yeah, and that goes back to what we said at the top there. A lot of times your strategy, if especially if you're working with a veteran musher or you're running puppy teams or B teams or lease teams or whatever they're called, they have a lot of that built into the strategy. So, yeah, it's interesting to see how it works. Jonathan, it's always a pleasure. Hope to have you back on soon.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
All right, and we're going to turn it right over to our coverage with Michelle and I. All right, Michelle, lots of information there between Jonathan and I's conversation. It's interesting to have two different perspectives with this that we're recording several hours apart, and we didn't get a lot of feedback from this. Are you guys interested in doing this sort of dual role episode, or should we go and do a bonus episode a little bit earlier where we talk about the day on the trail in a much earlier time frame, and then come back at night and then do what we typically do with Michelle and I? We're always looking to change things up and innovate a little bit. So we thought we'd try it new and see what you guys think. Michelle, let's break it down into our musher profile of the evening. It's my understanding we're doing a rookie.
Yes, Robert, we are doing rookie musher Joey Sabin. And he comes to the Iditarod from the mushing hub of Two Rivers, Alaska, though his story begins far from the trail in Granville, Michigan. Like many mushers, Sabin grew up with a love for animals, but the idea of running sled dogs really took hold when he was young, sparked in part by school projects about the Iditarod and the classic sled dog film, Iron Will. Years later, what started as a curiosity would turn into a full-time pursuit. Sabin first stepped into the dog yard in 2017 while working as a handler for veteran musher Sven Altman, a mentor who helped introduce him to the realities of kennel life and long-distance racing. From there, he immersed himself in the world of sled dogs, spending several seasons guiding glacier dog sled tours with Alaska Icefield Expeditions, and later working in Seward with Mitch Seavey's kennel. Those years on the ice and in the kennels helped refine his dog care, trail skills, and the day-to-day discipline required to build a competitive racing team. In 2020, Sabin launched his own kennel, VOA Racing, starting with just 5 dogs in Voyageurs National Park in northern Minnesota. What began as a small, ambitious kennel steadily expanded into a serious racing program. As his goals shifted toward long-distance competition, Sabin made the move back to Alaska, settling in Two Rivers, one of the most competitive mushing communities in the sport. He now operates VOA Racing with his partner, Willow Maynard, managing a growing team of sled dogs and preparing for the demands of the long trail. Today, their kennel includes 31 sled dogs, along with one small but spirited team member, a Jack Russell Terrier named Stevie Nicks. The kennel blends young talent with developing distance dogs, reflecting Sabin's focus on building a sustainable racing program for the future. Even before his Iditarod debut, Sabin has built a respectable mid-distance resume as he has competed in races such as the Copper Basin 300, the Yukon Quest Alaska 300, and the Yukon Quest Alaska 550. Gaining the experience required to qualify for the sport's most iconic race. His schedule leading into the 26th season included the Copper Basin 300 and the Yukon Quest Alaska 750, all part of the preparation for tackling the 1,000-mile journey to Nome. For Sabin, the path to the Iditarod has been less about a single moment and more about steady commitment. What began as a break from college to pursue a childhood dream gradually became a career centered on dogs, endurance, and the trail. Nearly a decade after first stepping into a kennel as a handler, he now finds himself on the starting line of the last great race. When he's not training his team, Saban stays active through running and strength training, making sure he can match the stamina and drive of the dogs that power his sled. For this rookie musher, the Iditarod represents not just a race, but the culmination of years spent learning the craft of mushing. From glacier tours and dog yards to the long miles of Alaska's toughest trails.
That dang movie, Iron Will, catches us all. That was the first movie I saw way back in 1994. It got me hooked on to the sport of mushing, and it's interesting how all these years later, the same Disney movie captures the fascination of mushers everywhere. We do a college class at the Alaska Pacific University, and every year we show that movie on the second week of class after they've already been on a sled a couple of times. And I love hearing the feedback from those guys about what they're doing right, what they're doing wrong, and what has been Disneyfied. Right, Michelle?
Absolutely. Now, a lot of people know our little backstory that I was swoon or won over by you because you told me that you were a dog musher, just like Iron Will. And that's how you grabbed a hold of me some 25 years ago today.
Speaking of today, today is our anniversary, 25 years, a quarter of a century, almost half of my life has been married to Michelle. Somebody commented on Facebook, if you know the two of us, you know that we have been meant to be each other. I know that was our friend Jennifer Stone that said that. What does that mean, by the way?
That we were meant to be together? It means that we are two pieces of a puzzle that fit together.
Two peas in a pod?
Yeah, sure.
Pepperoni on pizza?
Pepper on pizza.
Pepperoni on pizza?
Definitely not Canadian bacon and pineapple.
Oh my goodness.
I might have opened up a box right there.
So, guys, I know we're talking about two peas in the pod and whether you should be together, black and white. If you had to choose, would it be vanilla or chocolate ice cream?
I have a tendency to like chocolate chip.
Ah, that's the same of both. Okay, let's jump into our next segment. It is our moment in mushing history. Let's hear what we have.
Welcome to the Mushing Podcast. It's time for another memorable moment in mushing history. Sponsored by Peak Experience, providing experiential and team-building courses.
All right, let's see what we've got from Mushing History, Team and Trail, issue from November 17th, 1989. A letter to the editors. Poodle Promotion Power. Dear Cindy, I have seen and am glad to say a change of attitude for the better and how other mushers are more willing to accept a different breed of dog running in the sled dog races. I believe that to greatly expand sled dog racing, it is essential to include different types of dogs in the races. It will build a broad base of grassroots support for the sport. This is what baseball and other major sports have. It will give the news media more to write about, and this will put sled dog racing on the minds of the public and sponsors. I think there are two things that can be done to expand the sport. One is to get politicians involved. They can be checkers, handlers, trail guards, hand out trophies, or any number of things. The second way to help promote the sport is to have your company write up a story on you in their newsletter or magazine. Signed, John Sutter, Chugiak, Alaska. Boy, as we know, Sutter ran his poodle teams a few times in Iditarod, and it did not end well for him or the breed, with the Iditarod eventually adopting Rule 43 that specifically states only northern breed dogs can enter the race.
You know, Michelle, I brought these moments in mushing history out from our Team and Trail archives before the Iditarod kicked off about a week ago in terms of the Iditarod calendar, meaning last Thursday when we started our show. And I was trying to find interesting pieces of news that fit in to the Iditarod story and the history and all of that. And you've probably seen that in the last few, but my goodness, does this say almost the exact same things of what the media is saying about the expedition class this year. It's going to bring new media. It's going to bring more sponsor, more attention, more awareness, more excitement, all of those things they said about the expedition class. And it's been very black and white, not a lot of gray there. But Mr. John, running with Poodles guy, thought the same thing well over 35 years ago. What do you think about the comparison?
I think it's pretty dang close. But what really stood out to me, and I almost laughed out loud while I was telling the story, is his idea of getting the politicians involved as checkers, handlers, trail guards, and have them hand out trophies or any number of things. This literally made me chuckle. But it also reminded me of one of the issues, and I can't remember which one because they recycled the photo a couple of times. But Cindy's daughter, Deborah, is photographed with none other than, at the time, Nancy Reagan, before Mr. Reagan became president, handing her a trophy. So he would have been a candidate, I believe, at the time. But out on the campaign trail, they visited Laconia during one of the sprint dog races there. And she won, and Nancy gave her the trophy. So I'm laughing about all of these connections and things because, man, could you see one of our senators being a checker or a trail guard?
Well, speaking of which, my first point to that is I wonder if Nancy filled that trophy cup with jelly beans, Ronald Reagan's snack of choice. If you have no idea what we're talking about, you're probably over the age of 30. Go learn your history.
Under the age of 30.
Go learn your history. Lots of connections there for sure. But there have been a lot of politicians that have been involved with the Iditarod, in particular the ceremonial start. I know this year Lisa Murkowski was there, our senator here from Alaska. I know Sarah Palin has been part of these festivities.
Sure, but involved with the ceremonial start is different than what John was suggesting. John was suggesting that they get a little bit dirty.
I agree, but I will have to say I saw a photo today of Blitz, the Seattle Seahawks mascot, spent all kinds of time up here in Alaska during the ceremonial start. And if you don't know, the Seattle Seahawks are our home team up here in Alaska for the NFL. And he was up here, he or she is up making their rounds, and they won the Super Bowl this year. So they always say that the Iditarod is Alaska's circus, festival, Super Bowl, all of that. So maybe not politicians, but more mascots. I think Iditarod needs a very cool mascot.
I agree. I do agree with that.
All right, guys. I'm going to let you know right now. It is now 8:45 p.m. Alaska time. I have recorded 9 episodes of podcast today, running with the juniors there. 2 episodes of an off-road show that I do with my buddy Cooper over on the Team and Trail podcast, and my segment that I did with Jonathan. So I've been sitting here behind the mic for about 10 hours today, a very long time. But as we said at the beginning of our coverage, this reminds me of when They were hosting the Stanley Cup playoffs during COVID from their home studios, hooked up to Zoom or whatever they were using, and they were calling games from their couch. So I know that there is a very popular Facebook page called Mushing from the Couch or something like that. We're not sitting at our couch right now, but we're spending a lot of time behind the mic, aren't we?
We certainly are, Robert. And, you know, not only did you do all of those things today, we even had a Mushing Magazine meeting of sorts as well today. We have got a lot of hats and a lot of plates spinning in the air at all times. But you know what? We put in the extra time and effort every year for the past 16 years of podcasting together for the fact that we do love this sport. No matter how you participate in dog-powered adventure, we hope that you do continue listening. And that leads me to what's on tomorrow's podcast. The Halfway Award, the Mighty Yukon, traveling between villages, what does a village look like? And if you've got questions, be sure to leave us a text or voicemail by calling our hotline at 303-578-9881, or you can leave us an email at podcasting@mushing.com. And the last thing I would like to close with tonight is I would like to say how proud I was to hear of Jody's story today and how she fought off that bison, because it is Women's History Month, and what better way to celebrate that by having Jody overcome a really harrowing situation out there in the wilderness.
So guys, we've really appreciated the comments back and forth. I logged on to Spotify today and we had a bunch of comments over there, some that were a little old that I never got to. So I want to give a shout out or appreciation to that. Thank you guys for listening. On YouTube, our YouTube channel is really just the podcast feed with some captions. So if that is your pleasure, head on over there. Otherwise, make sure you check out where we are hosted. And probably the easiest place to listen anywhere is over on mushing.com. We have a player right at the top of the page. You can listen to that while you're doing your chores, on your dog walk, or whatever. Just hit play, put the phone in your pocket, put the earbuds in your ears, and you'll be ready to go. And we will be back tomorrow at around the same time, heading into that second half of the race. We'll see you guys then. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.